Hi, I'm Ken.
And I'm Dee.
And this is Antiques Freaks.
Only a podcast, every podcast.
What antiques are we talking about this week?
Just experimenting. We're going to talk about some specific antiques and a specific story that I absolutely love. I'm not even going to tell you what it is. We're going to get there. You want to go on this ride?
Hell yeah.
Get on board.
Buckled in.
The story starts 1985, London Christie's. The object in question, a dark, dark green glass bottle, sloshing with wine, engraved not only with Lafitte and 1787, but also the initials THJ. What could this mysterious object be?
Is this a bottle of Thomas Jefferson wine?
This is a bottle of Thomas Jefferson wine. This is the bottle of Thomas Jefferson wine.
The only one he ever made.
He only had one. but I don't know why you're saying it like that, because this Thomas Jefferson wine was unearthed with a variety of other historic 18th century wines in a cellar in Paris. Ah, le Grand Paris.
Mais ouais.
Why an American man's wine was in Paris, I guess this is just a question we're not gonna ask.
Oh, he went... Dee, you've listened to Hamilton, you know he went over there and then came back and then was like super smooth.
Yeah, that's true.
He was ambassador.
But he was l'ambassadeur. I have a note about that where it was just like...
L'ambassadeur.
Yeah, he got into wine while he was the ambassador during the revolution, which seems like weird. I can't put my finger on it, but it's like weird, right?
Something, something Dickens classic metaphor about wine thrown through the streets of Paris and that being like the blood that flowed through the streets of Paris like a year later.
Perfect. You nailed it. Yeah, exactly. Where he's just like, ah, such unrest. This Bordeaux, though.
Well, no. Dee, he was over there during the American Revolution. French Revolution happened after.
Yeah.
Inspired by our revolution.
But things were awesome in France.
Things were not super great. Like, the peasants were still eating grass, but Thomas Jefferson was used to that because he was a slave-owning piece of shit.
Well, yeah. He was just like, as it should be, this is a fine Bordeaux.
It's like, of course you have an underclass that you just crush under your heel day in, day out. That's how we do it.
Well, Ken, how did you guess the theme of this whole episode? So,
not that I'm bitter.
We're gonna get a lot of that, I think. It was unearthed with a bunch of other, like, really rare 18th century wines. I'm gonna mess these up all real bad because I don't speak the French.
Hell yeah.
A Chateau d'Icon, Mouton, Margaux, and they were all initialed THJ. I was gonna ask who THJ is, but Ken has guessed very accurately that, supposedly,
Thomas Hamburger Jefferson.
Thomas American Hamburger Jefferson, who invented it.
Yeah, that's why it's American.
He was like, oh, everyone's so hungry. What's the fattiest food I could be eating?
In their face. Not giving to them, but eating in front of them while they gnaw the grass that's left in the fields after they've been forced to harvest it for like 18 hours a day to feed the king in his fucking palace at Versailles.
It's how am I supposed to feel when I read, like completely non-critically, someone writes, Thomas Jefferson cultivated a love of fine wines during the famine.
Yeah.
Like, oh, you know. Is that when?
Christ, what an asshole.
So apparently, he did in fact have his wines initialed, so that fucking Ben Franklin wouldn't goddamn drink it all.
Is that the real reason, or is that just we're assuming because we know Ben Franklin?
That's what we're assuming because we know Ben Franklin, and because apparently he did group orders with Ben Franklin a lot.
Oh, man.
And every time he did, he would have the bottles initialed so that he'd know whose was whose. And I'm extrapolating so that Ben Franklin wouldn't drink his goddamn wine.
So, okay, did Thomas Jefferson and Ben Franklin take advantage of a wine Groupon? Or or did they split the cost of a Wink membership?
Now, that's what I'm curious about. Nobody got into the nature of these weird big group or like, just like the high strangeness of Thomas Jefferson needing, like, a crate of wine at all times.
He had to drink to forget the atrocities he was committing against his fellow man.
I did call him well-known shitty wino. So that's like, that's what I know about Jefferson. But back to the bottle at hand. It was a mostly full, beautiful dark color. And it was suggested at auction that, if its provenance was true, its value was inestimable.
Now, we're talking about it on our podcast, so I'm gonna use my fucking wizard future-telling powers here and surmise that perhaps the provenance will not be quite so easily established as we might have hoped.
Well, quite frankly, everyone at Christie's is infuriated you would say such a thing. Cannot believe it. Oh my god. Oh my god.
How could I possibly question Christie's? Unless I am an agent of Sotheby's.
Perhaps you are, sir. That actually becomes like a weird beat in this.
Oh, God. My predictive powers are out of control.
So, the story checked out. Historically speaking, according to one Michael Broadbent, famed sommelier and the head of Christie's wine department, which is a thing. And if that doesn't fill your heart with rage, I don't know how else, too. Because despite being into antiques, I also just hate it.
Now that's true passion. D, the opposite of love isn't hate, it's indifference.
Lord. Lord. So in addition to just being a wine expert himself, Mr. Broadbent had it inspected by sundry other Christie's experts, notably their glass experts. Glass experts said that the bottle and the engraving matched the style of 18th century French wine.
Hey!
So they said, yeah, that's fine. And Mr. Broadbent claimed that he had done the historical legwork to back up that it was not only plausible, but very possible that this was Thomas Jefferson's wine.
Backing up to the glass people.
Mm-hmm.
The glass may very well be 18th century. The container may very well be 18th century. But the thing about containers is that you can take things out of them and put other things into them.
Yes.
Without changing the container.
Famously, that is a thing you can do.
I'm sure this will not come up again. Let's move on.
It will not. But in defense of those people, their only job was to say, is this bottle old? I'd also just
They're absolutely on point. Yeah. No offense at them.
What's more, Michael Broadbent, he drank one or two of them.
Wait, sorry.
Yeah, 18th century wine.
Okay, so he was like, this wine is possibly like 200 years old.
Yeah.
I'm gonna drink it just to be sure.
Yes. Now here's the kicker. He drank the wine, specifically a 1784 Écans, and he said, well, it tastes fantastic. And that went down in his notes about how he knew it was real.
Does this man not know where vinegar comes from?
He has no idea. I don't think he knows much.
Okay.
So, the Lafitte sold at auction for $157,000 in 80s money.
So roughly $700,000 today?
Roughly, yeah.
Cool.
It sold to Christopher Forbes, son of Malcolm Forbes. Yes, that Forbes.
Forbes of the Forbes magazine?
Yeah. This was Forbes of Forbes magazine's son, the vice president of Forbes magazine.
The very Forbes that made Griffin McElroy a 30 under 30 media luminary?
That Forbes.
My God.
And hopefully will make us 30 right in the midst of 30 luminaries.
You know they do like 40 under 40 and 50 under 50.
Oh, right? Do they?
Yeah,
well, there we are.
They go up as far as I understand.
So Mr. Forbes.
Also, we're never going to get
Mr. Forbes, stop listening to this episode because it's not going to get any better for you.
Maybe Mr. Forbes is a masochist and he just enjoys us dunking on him.
Then in which case, Mr. Forbes, tune in.
Maybe Mr. Forbes is into FinDom and we can like... actually makes...
Mr. Forbes, this is an order. Give me your money.
Mr. Forbes, this is an order. Donate to our Patreon.
Donate to our Patreon and a lot of it. He was quoted about the saying about the purchase that day as... and this will make you feel... just tell me how this makes you feel. It's more fun than the opera glasses Lincoln was holding when he was shot. And we have those too.
Now, I know how I am supposed to feel as, like, an empathetic and decent human being.
What, angry?
How I actually feel as a big, grim, goth fuck.
Oh, so that's kind of cool.
Is that I would give anything to touch the opera glasses that Lincoln was holding when he was shot.
Same. But it's the tone.
I do not think Thomas Jefferson's wine is nearly as cool. But again, that's also probably just because I'm a horrible goth cretin.
It was not about being, well, like, it's a different weight, right? Like, you would hold those and be like, oh my god, there's so much history and tragedy behind this object. You wouldn't be like, how fun! He died!
It'd be a little fun.
It'd be a little fun. Forbes' purchase set off a fever. Forbes was, you know, he was a tastemaker, so if he bought it, it's got to be good, right? People who went on to purchase bottles from the collection that this Lafitte had come from included the editor of Wine Spectator. Can't imagine how that must have felt to be him later.
Why would that be, D?
Because he made a good purchase.
Oh, yes, of course.
A mysterious Middle Eastern man that nobody ever identified ever again.
Okay.
And Bill Koch. I'm going to call him that so no one gets confused, although it is. Please, God, don't email me. I know it's pronounced Coke, but if I say that, it's going to be weird because this is an audio format. So we're saying Koch.
I'm saying Coke, just to fuck with you.
All right.
Also, not to interrupt this great list, but was the $700,000 in today's money for the entire wine collection or the single bottle?
Single bottle.
So was it $700,000 of today's money per bottle?
Yes, roughly.
I have to go to France and break open all of the wine bottles and flood them through the streets as a precursor to We All Know What Will Follow.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, your great list of people who bought this wonderful wine and had no regrets.
Well, the list ends here.
Oh, okay.
other people didn't buy it, but we stopped being interested right about Bill Koch. Son of Fred Koch of Koch Industries of Massachusetts, actually.
Oh, hey. We know from there.
We know. Amazing.
You okay there, buddy?
Yeah. All right. It's really good. Koch Industries is famously a petroleum and fossil fuel processing plant company that has, you know, like any rich fuck, a million subsidiary companies.
Trickle down economics.
It works. It just works. God, if only I could kill Reagan too. This is a bloodthirsty episode.
Casket full of jelly beans.
God, man, wine just makes me so mad. Koch didn't stop there. He went on to buy 4 total bottles of wine from a variety of different dealers. He was very proud of these wines.
As one should be?
I don't think... He just had a cellar full of it, and he was quoted multiple times telling people flat out that he didn't buy wine to drink it.
Okay, because, like, at least all the people buying and selling racehorses take them outside.
Yeah, they pet them on the nose. Mm. God, I hope they do.
The trainers do.
What's the point of having a horse?
Somebody pets the horses on the nose.
Good. So, and that was far from the only thing Koch collected. He collected everything. Like rich people do, he just had a lot of collections. In fact, he pretty much had a miniature museum in his house. Famously, he does have Custer and Sitting Bull's guns.
But does he sneak down in the middle of the night and take them both out at the same time and aim them at each other and go pew 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 pew?
Almost certainly.
Okay.
The kind of guy this guy is, absolutely he must have. Especially drunk on all that wine.
He's not drinking the wine, Dee. He's explicitly not drinking the wine.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I was foolish. The Boston Museum of Fine Arts wants to do a whole thing, like a whole show of Koch's personal collection, because he's a very important Massachusetts guy, and he has a lot of really important artifacts. The thing about having a show at a museum is you have to get vetted. Problem with antiques is that, if you've been listening to this show for any period of time, they're notoriously difficult to vet. When they got to the wine, which was, of course, being a near 200-year-old wine, which is incredibly rare, they said, well, where's the paperwork? And all Koch could produce was Mr. Broadbent's auction liner notes saying, I'm pretty sure it's real.
Wait, so there's no, like, receipts or shipping records or anything? No paper trail tying this to Thomas Jefferson?
Zero. Wait, there's more. So Koch's staff was tasked with the job of trying to track down the paperwork. He was confident that it was real, so it had to be somewhere, right? Long story short, they go to Monticello.
Oh, fun.
Yeah, a good time, an excellent time. With all due respect, I think the people at Monticello are mostly doing a lot of good work.
Yeah, I know, like, the people doing the historical shit now are great, but, like, the reason it's a historical monument is less great.
That's true, yeah, that's true. It is kind of a shame they have to set up there. So, they contacted the Thomas Jefferson Foundation, and mere days later, Susan Stein, at the time the curator, called the staff saying, there's no way those are his.
Wait, so to recap, it didn't occur to Christie's to call the Thomas Jefferson experts to verify a Thomas Jefferson antique?
But wait, there's more.
We're never getting invited to Christie's.
We're never, ever. We might get an invite to Sotheby's.
Sotheby's, if you're listening, donate to our Patreon.
Well, the thing that gets me about that is that, like, it was immediate. Usually when people are doing, like, this kind of hardcore sleuthing, it takes weeks, months, sometimes years.
Yeah, because usually they don't think to call the people who are experts in the thing.
No, I mean, even the experts in the thing, it might take some time. Like, their job would be basically to look at the records of his whole life and try to find an incident where he bought this wine. So it would be difficult. The suspicious thing is, it wasn't difficult. And Koch called. Susan Stein pretty much immediately said, oh no, we've been through this before. It's not. We're pretty sure it's not real.
Wait, so the museum called, they said not real, and then Koch called and then it's not real?
No, the Koch called the museum and they said, this isn't real, fam.
Okay.
With a speed that suggested this wasn't their first rodeo.
So someone has called them before to verify this.
Ah, the mystery deepens.
Someone did think to do the obvious fucking thing and call the Thomas Jefferson people to ask questions about Thomas Jefferson. But when they didn't receive the answer they were hoping for, they just kind of pretended they'd never called in the first place?
Well, now it's just Avengers Endgame spoilers.
Everyone dies. They're all finally free.
Oh my god. Me too. And especially me. So, in response to being told that he might have a fake, Koch said, and I quote, "I bought so much art, so many guns, so many other things that if somebody's out to cheat me, I want the son of a bitch to pay for it. Also, it's a fun detective story."
Is this the same guy that we got the Abraham Lincoln's opera glasses quote from?
No, this is a different rich fuck.
Or is this two completely different rich jack-offs being the exact same kind of tasteless and stupid?
The latter.
I love antiques.
Some fun facts about Koch and his relationship with wine. He got into it because he got hepatitis at MIT somehow. And as a result, he couldn't drink hard liquor because it affects your liver very badly. Except that he somehow thought wine was an exemption to this. And he started he got into wine, and I'm not even making this up, but God, I wish I were. He just went to restaurants and ordered whatever was most expensive, and then wrote down the ones he liked. I wish you could see Ken's face, it's great.
How the fuck did he get into MIT?
Well, that's the sick thing is he is actually a rather brilliant engineer.
Is he?
Yes, chemical engineer.
Is he?
Yeah, he has a PhD. And MIT's, it's not just any school.
Listen, I love a good PhD as much as the next guy, but sometimes I get the impression that they just kind of hand them out.
Could you imagine a chemical engineer saying, like, my liver might be shot, but wine isn't alcohol?
That's the part that I'm sticking on. That is the part that's giving me trouble, because how? And I know you don't have an answer.
I don't.
But I'm still going to ask, how? Okay. All right, sure.
So, in 1985, part of why this was so shocking to everyone to hear is that wine fraud was pretty much unheard of.
What?
Despite the fact that it was absurdly easy.
Yeah.
The long and short of it is that wine fraud was unheard of because nobody thought of it. Nobody thought about it. Plenty of people thought of it and then defrauded wine.
Okay. I was gonna say, like, there's no way. There's no way that people didn't look at this, like, giant neon green glowing flashing target labeled free money and just passed it by.
Yup. Serena Sutcliffe of Sotheby's wine department once joked that more 1945 Mouton was consumed on the 50th anniversary of the vintage in 1995 than was ever produced to begin with.
She seems fun.
She seems like she's part of a reputable octonaut. Anyway, never gonna get a job at Christie's. but it was really easy. Almost nobody at the time, and I think even now it is relatively rare, nobody bought wine from the chateau. Everything was done in underhanded deals directly between the buyers and an agent. Meaning, it was really easy for someone selling bunk wine to disappear. They didn't have to prove where they got it from.
So you could just show up to Christie's with a crate of wine saying, Thomas Jefferson, definitely, money please, and then just go on your merry way?
Not only could you, that's exactly what happened. You could so hard that we're here talking about it. Here's the thing. Koch had the money to find them. So he tracked down his four bottles and the one that Forbes had purchased to one man. Hardy Rodenstock. That sounds like a fake name to you. Strap in. He was a mysterious figure from probably Germany who did have a career managing pop stars in Germany during the 70s.
Sure.
Yeah, you just do that. He was wealthy. But much like Tommy Wiseau, nobody knew much else about him. There were hundreds of rumors. He claimed to be a professor. He, on other turns, explained his wealth by cheekily hinting at the idea that he was good at the stock market. His name had suggested that he might be the heir of the Rodenstock glasses fortune. And he did wear those.
My money's on he's D.B. Cooper.
He's D.B. Cooper. You solved it. You cracked it.
I did it. I cracked the case.
He was way into wine. Super into wine. He was so into wine that he actually claimed that wine was better before grapes were bred to resist a specific parasite that had almost destroyed the international wine industry.
Wine was cool when it was imperiled?
Quote, in the pre-Phylloxera wines of Ycon, you find more flavor, more caramel, more singularity, more power, more class. He claimed he could taste the difference in grapes that did or did not get destroyed by bugs.
He drinks only organic wine?
He drinks only bug wine.
Only organic non-GMO wine.
Do you think the caramel was from the bugs? The notes of caramel?
Something something proteins? I don't know.
Yeah. He did once boast to Wine Spectator that he had tasted more vintages of old Ycon than the owner of the chateau had, and at the time, the chateau owner had to agree.
That seems more like a dunk on the chateau than any statement about him.
Yeah, I thought the same thing. Just like a really depressed chateau owner going, yeah, probably. I don't drink a lot of wine. I make as much money as you, Mr. Hardenstock. Rodenstock? I'm not going to get his name right ever again.
Rosenstern.
Guildenkratz. He was most famous, in addition to just being weird and rich, for holding huge wine parties. Enormous wine parties. He would have crazy amounts of wine from vintages people had only ever read about, and they were all there for the taking.
Just pouring them out onto the floor, watching them flow down the grand staircase like the blood that would soon follow?
Man, that would be great. It was a lot more laid back than that. But it was close. He was personal friends with glassmaker Riedel. He had his own wine glasses made by Riedel, called the Rodenstock glass. Everything was custom. Everything was to the highest degree. People eventually would end up getting banned from his parties because he had a no-spitting rule, which if you've ever been to wine tasting is unusual. Because tasting wine, if you drink a lot, you can't taste anymore. You're just drunk. He didn't allow that. People would get blocked from the parties by sneaking in spittoons. Because they didn't want to, because they would see how many wines were on offer and they didn't want to get that stupid drunk.
So they had, like, little reverse flasks hidden.
Yeah, exactly. And he would boot them.
God, I hate the rich.
He would famously say, you don't spit away history. Drink it.
Here's the thing. I'm with him on that. This is still crazy, but I am with him on that.
That's fair.
If you're gonna fucking drink wine, fucking drink the wine.
It was just that maybe he should have put fewer wines out. In a bit of foreshadowing, later, another famous sommelier would quote that he had never gone to a lot of these parties because he didn't like all the excitement, and he said, it seemed strange that Rodenstock only ever busted out the really good wine right at the end when everyone was drunk. And he said, without a hint of irony or understanding, that you could hardly taste a wine that fine when you were already in the cups. So he didn't see the point.
Interesting.
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 So Rodenstock was, as you may have guessed by now, the man who not only had the Jefferson wine, he claimed to have unearthed it from a dank, mysterious Paris cellar basement.
In the catacombs?
In the catacombs. Huh?
In the Court of Miracles?
Possibly.
They know how to party.
They do. Probably better than him. They also know how to, I don't know, hang you?
Yeah, party.
That's in the movie. So, Rodenstock hadn't melted into the background after the incredibly famous Forbes sale. He stepped right into the limelight. He wanted everyone to know that that was his bottle that Forbes had purchased.
It's me!
It was I! So his official story was that someone in Paris, he never said who, had broken down a cellar wall in Paris. He never said where, other than Paris. Found some dusty old bottles and called Rodenstock to sell them because he was the wine guy, I guess.
It is kind of funny that I just feel like Paris, of all places, has a lot of wine guys.
It's got a lot of wine guys, yeah. It's got a lot of tunnels underneath the ground, so none of this is particularly implausible. It's gonna be one of those episodes where I say a lot of rude things about the French, huh?
Isn't that every episode?
So he also refused to say exactly how many bottles he'd gotten, which, while the first two refusals made sense to a certain extent, the last one didn't make a lot of sense to anybody.
No.
And, in addition, he went on from there to uncover all sorts of rare and fantastical wines, some of them bordering on, and I'm using this word very deliberately, mythical.
Ambrosia.
Sometimes he would collect these incredibly rare wines days before a themed party. So if he was doing a party where it was all wines from 1942, he would say to a friend, like, if only I had this one very rare 1942 wine. And they'd be like, well, it's gonna be a dope party anyway, because you don't let us spit. and then, like, the day before, he'd call that friend and be like, you'll never guess what I found. Oh, it's on.
Listen, you're doing a lot of hanging on this guy for procrastinating.
Yeah. Well, no, but he delivered in the end, didn't he?
Yeah, exactly. So don't come down so hard on us procrastinators.
He also claimed to have every year of Vicon, which was interesting because the chateau owner did not. And Tsar Nicholas's lost cache of wine, which was a top quality Bordeaux somehow.
He has an awful lot of wines owned by rich people right before the poor people murdered them and smashed all of their shit.
Yeah, I pointed that. Nobody else points that out when you're reading about this, but, like, I caught that, yeah.
I feel like if I were a French and or Russian peasant on the eve of the revolution, my hands still wet with the blood of my oppressor, I might drink their wine.
Yeah, I probably wouldn't have left the wine cellar untouched. Like, but this we cannot.
Anyway, so wines.
So a lot of people drank these wines. And interestingly, even these hundreds of year old bottles of wines tasted fantastic. Beautiful. Fresh, even. In fact, a lot of people constantly commented on how you would never know that the wine was that old. Rich people have
never heard of vinegar.
No sense of fucking self-reflection.
Well, they've never encountered dust or anything that tasted bad. So, like,
well,
that's all taken care of for them.
Well, and to a certain extent, it gets into this, like, it cost a lot. Why would it taste bad? And I did do some checking. Apparently, old wines do taste not awesome. Some of them do taste still like wine. They don't always immediately turn into vinegar. But I kept reading the words, like, moldy, dusty. Like, they have the flavor of a thing that's been sitting
for 100 or more years.
Yeah.
No fucking shit.
So, here's another fucking crazy thing that you'll never believe. Oh my god. Broadbent, the man who sold the wine at Christie's, the head of Christie's Wine, was a regular at these parties.
What?
He was always there.
Incredible.
I know. It's really hard to believe.
I can't believe.
To the extent that when Broadbent wrote a book about rare and fine wine, half of it was based on his experience with Rodenstock's collection. And he quoted Rodenstock a lot, excessively, saying, none of this would have been possible without him. I'd never have seen these wines.
Interessant.
Now, after uncovering all this, Koch wanted blood and prison time.
For himself? I can make that happen.
Yeah, I know. I can get his own blood out. It's easy. He hired a private lawyer who was also retired FBI agent Jim Elroy.
Sure.
And listening to this man talk, you can tell that being hired by Koch every time was just a delight for him, because it was always something fucking weird.
It always some dumb rich person thing.
He did crow once that Koch had spent, by the end of the investigation, that he'd spent more than twice what he'd spent on the wines in his quest to punish Rodenstock as hard as he could.
Can you imagine if that money were bent towards something useful or good for society at large?
You know, what would be a harder ha-ha at Rodenstock than feeding America's hungry kids?
Or, like, sheltering the poor, or, like, funding a hospital, or, like,
just, medicine? Pour some money into medicine research.
Pour some money into lowering the price of pharmaceuticals.
That's a fun one. I like that one. Rich people, if you're listening, that would be cool. We'd think you're really cool.
Or you could just donate to our Patreon.
Or you could donate to our Patreon and we'll all do all that for you. So, Mr. Elroy, who again is a retired FBI agent, man, how cool is this guy? He got together a literal A-team of international special agents, including MI5 and Scotland Yard, as well as wine experts, and they set off. They do discover that Broadbent had been to Monticello about the wine bottles.
What?
Before the auction.
What?
At the time, a woman named Cinder Goodwin, who wins the award for coolest name I've ever heard, her whole job, her whole passion, her whole point in life was reading everything Jefferson did all day in his diaries, which he kept meticulously.
Oh my god.
She has written multiple reports about just what he was like in the day-to-day. There are few people who have a deeper understanding of the mundanities of Jefferson's evil life than Cinder Goodwin.
Damn.
She said, after Broadbent had come to her, that she'd read his journals all the time. There's never a mention of him buying a 1787 vintage specifically, the bottle being marketed. She would know. She has personal records of all of his business transactions that she's read extensively. She goes through them and says, no, he never bought this particular wine. Furthermore, even the initials are signed wrong.
Wait, okay. One, I'm still reeling from the revelation that this wine might be fake. Two,
right?
They couldn't even forge his signature correctly?
Well, he had a really minute quirk that is the kind of thing you'd only notice if you're reading his journals day in, day out all the time. Instead of th.j, he would write th:j.
I didn't know I could hate him more.
Right? It's just yet, a little thing, and yet you're just like, fuck that.
And yet here I am. Like, here I am, rocking him like a hurricane.
So, she gives Broadbent all of this information, not a drop of it mixes with the auction catalog. Normally, in an auction catalog, it is not unusual to list reservations or difficulties producing provenance. Broadbent left it out. Afterwards, the Times did publish Broadbent himself, saying directly, he had no proof except for circumstantial evidence.
Oh, but to crush this man's head like the very grapes that made his wine.
After the auction, Cinder Goodwin, who is the coolest person of all time, wrote an entire report on the likelihood that the wine was Thomas Jefferson's.
Was it just, like, the word zero, just written really big?
The killing line was, were there no Thomases, Theodores, Theophiles, or Jacksons, Joneses, and Julians who also had a taste for fine Bordeaux wine and who could have been in Paris?
I love her.
Rodenstock shot back, one should courteously keep back one's dubious and unfounded remarks, and one shouldn't make oneself important in front of the press, he said to the press.
He said to the press about the woman whose entire life's work is reading everything Thomas Jefferson ever wrote about his day-to-day, including his wine purchases.
In response to that, almost specifically, because immediately other people in the press were just like, this woman is an expert in Jefferson. He said, yes, but she doesn't know wine.
Sweetie, that's not the issue here.
But wait, Broadbent wrote to Monticello afterwards too, and also publicly to the papers. Broadbent wrote, after tasting the wine in question, that it was, quote, sensationally good. If anyone had any lingering doubts about the authenticity of this extraordinary old wine, they were completely removed.
Old wine doesn't taste good!
Admittedly, there is no written evidence that these particular bottles had been in the possession of Jefferson, but I am now firmly convinced that this is indeed the wine Jefferson ordered.
Okay, so here's the thing. Normal people wine, after a long time, turns to vinegar. But wine that is owned by historically notable people, once it realizes it has been purchased by a historically notable person and not yet drunk, it conserves itself chemically, preserving the very good boxed wine flavor it originally had.
It makes it delicious, yeah.
Yes. That's just science.
Yeah, that's science. Another factor that doesn't fit in anywhere else, but I was really hoping you'd say something like this. Much like other things that are rare, rare wines aren't the good ones.
No.
Because not only did people drink those a lot, but it was very, very common, even before wine collection kind of became a thing, for if there was a very good wine, you would store tons of it to see how it aged. So it's not rare. Rare wines are wines nobody fucking cared about that just every jack-off was drinking in the street, meaning there's very little left over because no one preserved any. So the likelihood that it would taste good is still plummeting through the floor. Even if it had been preserved perfectly, it wouldn't be a particularly good wine. So, after the Forbes purchase of the Jefferson bottle, another wine enthusiast named Felix, whose name I will stop saying, and will just become the other wine enthusiast, he'd purchased a Jefferson bottle before the auction, much more cheaply than Forbes had.
What?
And as a result, he tried to sell his bottle, went to Rodenstock for the provenance, and was completely blocked. Rodenstock said that he had sold the bottle to him on the understanding that he would not be reselling it. He said, well, we didn't do that in paper, and also fuck you. But he went to Sotheby's. And Sotheby's immediately turned it down for its uncertain provenance. They heard everything there was to hear, and they said, no.
Fucking clowning on Christie's.
Totally clowning on Christie's. So as a result, Frerichs, pissed off, he went and had it carbon dated. Because rich people truly have nothing better to do. If you're asking, is carbon dating expensive? Yes.
Oh no, I knew that. I just
Didn't realize I could hold so much hate in my heart, but continue.
Well, yeah, it's funny. It's like the Grinch, but opposite.
My heart shriveled up 3 sizes that day.
The carbon dating resulted in claiming that it was created sometime after 1962. Frerich sued Rodenstock. One, on the grounds that Rodenstock had somehow adulterated the wine, not that it was fraudulent. And then Frerich ended up paying off Rodenstock when he countersued for defamation.
What?
Basically, for a variety of reasons that if you're into antiques you're familiar with, the court couldn't prove that it was fake. All they could prove was that it wasn't completely right. What you said earlier about the bottle possibly being from the 18th century, at that point they were just like, parts of this could be real and we can't say it wasn't Thomas Jefferson's. All we can say is that he fucked with the wine inside. That's the only proof that we have. So they're positing that he had just replaced the wine and sold it. And so that the only part he was guilty of messing up and mis-selling was tampering with the wine inside.
That makes it fake.
But not legally fake by the definition of being fake.
I need to go lie down.
So, Elroy uncovered all of this. Elroy, if you'll remember, is the private investigator that Koch hired. He also uncovered that Rodenstock was actually Meinhard Gerge. George? Meinhard. Not a Rodenstock at all.
What?
He'd never been any of the things he said he was.
What?
He had been a simple railway engineer, which arguably is way cooler.
I was gonna say, how the mighty have fallen.
Like, I would
he was a railway engineer, and now he's this?
Now he's just some drunk bastard. Elroy also discovered that Rodenstock was probably a mixer, a person prized at vineyards for their ability to make wonderful blends of grape varietals, and also hated by vineyards for their ability to blend wine forgeries.
He makes a mean rosé.
He really does. Basically, he just found out that he was known for blending wines, which of course in a fake wine investigation sets off that did he mix a wine to trick people, which is an art form in and of itself. I mentioned earlier that these people are very desirable at vineyards for making the blends that they sell.
Wanna put my tender wine in a blender?
You were waiting so long to do that. He also discovered that one of the reasons forgeries were so goddamned easy, people who bought expensive wine almost never drank it.
Eat the rich.
I just drink the wine that they won't.
Drink it, you won't.
Meaning nobody was drinking this and saying, wait, this doesn't taste right. The notable exception being everyone involved in this story, however.
Yeah, except they're also not drinking it and saying it doesn't taste right. They're drinking it and saying it tastes just like the barefoot wine I get at the liquor store, therefore it's amazing.
There you go. There's the other problem with forgeries. Almost no one, including experts, know what they're talking about.
Because if no one has drank this wine since it was produced in 17, what the fuck? We don't know what it's supposed to taste like.
Exactly what a wine historian had said. He said, what on earth do any of the people claiming that it's real have to compare it to? Sommeliers of current wines get their expertise from comparing wines. Without a basis of comparison, you can't say definitively anything. You could be drinking anything, and I think most people are familiar with the varieties of experiments people have done that prove this. It's very easy to influence someone's perception of wine just by telling them that it's fancy. By inflating the price point, by putting a prettier label on it, there have been countless studies of this. And even people who are specifically trained to have a taste for wine are very easily fooled by this. Because wine is 99% perception. And 1% actually grapes. There is a fun anecdote that the wine historian mentioned earlier said, in which he had worked previously at a restaurant. Someone had ordered a 1982 Petrus, which is a very, very rare wine. It's about $6,000 a bottle. Ordered 3. Loved the first one. Hated the second one and sent it back, said it was weird. Loved the third one. Do you know what the difference was?
One of them was real?
The second one was real.
I can't even be mad.
So much of this story is backed on the concept of wine being a weird lie. Continuing with the story at hand, Elroy goes to the Swiss Alps to have the wine cesium tested.
What the fuck is a cesium?
I don't want to get too much into it because it's like grim and kind of creepy.
Okay.
But it tests for certain reactive chemicals that are only present post-1940.
Ah.
So basically, if they're there, It says this rough chunk. If they're not, it says this rough chunk in either direction. Both bottles are pre-1940s, which is a surprise. These are now old wines.
Okay.
There's no proof that they are 18th century wines. And at this point, I don't think anyone believes that. But they are old. So, this sucks. He's trying to build a case that this guy lied. And now all of his scientific evidence says, not exactly. He sends the bottles to Quantico to be analyzed by a ballistics expert he knows.
So, if you shoot the wine...
No. He was on a plane. He ended up getting passports for the wine because he was carrying around these bottles and you'd have to pay, like, fees to import wine, basically. So he was on the plane and he was holding one of the bottles of wine and running his thumb over the engraving. And apparently he was just really mad that he hadn't been able to prove it yet, even though everyone kind of knew. And he just said, whatever, anyone could have engraved this. And then had his moment where he's like, anyone could have engraved this. So he sent it off to his ballistics expert because they were good at identifying very small abrasive markings and how they were made.
Oh my god.
So the ballistics expert refers Elroy to Max Erlacher, an Austrian glass craftsman and expert engraver. Erlacher does some serious studying of the bottle, determines the engravings were not done by a copper wheel, which was sort of like a foot pedal sewing machine for engraving, like a mechanical drill. It was made by something electrical. Something with about the quality of the mark making. It was too smooth. It was at a weird angle. And everything suggested he'd seen it hundreds of times before with, say, a Dremel. Elroy mimicked this in his own home that same day and engraved a random bottle of wine in a near-perfect replica of the engraving with a Dremel.
Damn.
As a result, they finally had some proof Koch files a civil complaint, which weirdly refers to Koch as charming and debonair but a fraudster. You ever notice that in, like, rich people wine conflicts, they always get, like, a little gay?
Have rich people never met someone who's actually charming?
I don't think they have. He's just, like, he's human and he can talk and they're just, like, remarkable. He doesn't have, like, the fucking dead eyes.
Except he does. He just got contacts.
So... the problem was, the suit was still really shaky. They had to prove several things for this to become a criminal case. They had to prove that he'd messed with the wine inside, that the bottles weren't old, that the engraving was fake, and it never belonged to Jefferson. And they also had to prove that Rodenstock had known all of this the whole time.
Well, they know he contacted the Jefferson people.
No, they know Broadbent had. They don't know Rodenstock had. And Broadbent, weirdly, wasn't on trial for any of this.
Why not? Wait. Wine not?
Mostly because he hadn't done anything criminal. He made a big dumb goof up, but he hadn't criminally and knowingly defrauded people.
So basically...
he believed someone like an idiot, which isn't a crime.
So if you want to get away with murder, open an auction house?
Basically.
Okay.
Well, it was just that he had made poor choices and he had conducted himself ethically in the antiques world by not sharing everything he knew. But that's not a crime. What Rodenstock done had kind of been a crime, but they had to prove that Rodenstock had been behaving knowingly, claiming that these were Thomas Jefferson's, when it was beyond the shadow of a doubt now that they were not.
Why the fuck is it harder to get convicted for wine fraud than it is to get convicted for possession of weed?
But rich people?
Anyway.
So, Elroy tricked Rodenstock. He sent him a letter that said, "This can all be over if you just tell me that you can vouch for the authenticity of these bottles. That they definitely belonged to Thomas Jefferson. And if he did that, he would be an act of knowing and legally continuing a known fraud." In writing. He did this. He wrote a letter saying, "I absolutely for sure know these were Thomas Jefferson's bottles."
Okay. I mean, that's a choice.
Now, during the suit, not only did Broadbent continue to vouch for the authenticity of the wines, despite a mounting pile of evidence... Christie's continued to sell wines they'd acquired from Rodenstock.
Wait. Listen. The first 5 wines were fake, but surely the next 500 wines won't be fake.
Koch had started sending them threatening letters, telling them he was going to sue them if they continued selling these wines, since it was overwhelmingly likely that they were from a fraudster.
Yeah.
They did not care. They continued to sell them. Or try. The wines did not sell, because this had hit the wine community.
Yeah.
A man named Russell Fry at the same time was suing the Wine Library of California for sending him bunk wine. Big surprise, it had also come from Rodenstock.
There's a wine library in California?
It's just the name of a store.
Oh,
it's a wine dealer.
Oh, okay, Jesus.
Meanwhile, Elroy had found definitive evidence that Rodenstock had been a wine mixer. He found an old landlord of Rodenstock's that had said that during an eviction scuffle, he had found an entire workshop in the basement that involved hundreds of bottles of wines and fake labels. Now, he tried to alert the police, but they didn't care.
Because France.
There was no sign of a crime happening to them. Because France. Meanwhile, as the case continued, wine expert and historian Molyneux Berry was sent to examine Rodenstock's personal wine cellar. He found over 135 examples of wines that were highly suspicious or overtly fake. That's not even counting ones that would have been fake if he'd looked a little closer.
Oh dear.
Some fakes he actually determined based solely on his knowledge of their rarity. For example, Koch claimed to have 2 of a run of 5 wines. Matter of history, in fact, that only 5 had ever been made. And what's more, 19 had sold at auction.
Okay.
Other cellar masters who got in touch with about some of his rarer finds just said that those things never got made. They would come in, there's a magnum of wine, which is an enormous bottle. He would claim to have magnums from a certain chateau, and they would say they never made those in magnums. Like, there's a matter of record that it was never created, so how could it possibly be there? Molyneux Berry himself said that he had been on many wine purchasing trips in Russia. What was the likelihood that after he had experienced the height and depth and breadth of what Russia had to offer for rare wines, that this man, a trade engineer from the middle of nowhere Germany, had found the Tsar's missing stash that had probably never existed to begin with, because as you said earlier, it had happened during a violent revolution.
Yeah.
Basically, it was all over. Koch was feverish at this point. He had his entire wine cellar examined. Walt, has a separate room for the fakes, and is attempting, I believe to this day, to sue anyone he thinks sold him fake wine. Anyone at all. And this story ends with nothing happening. 2018, Rodenstock died. Charges were never formally brought against him. And nothing of any note ended up happening.
Okay, but did he have an oak casket and did they fill it with wine before they buried it?
No, lots of people made jokes that it wasn't his body, though.
Are you saying the casket wasn't as full-bodied as they were expecting?
Oh! Oh, good wine joke, high five.
At last, after an hour in, I finally made a good wine joke.
Did you believe this was supposed to be short?
Whoops.
We always.
You gave me an opportunity to mouth off about rich people and you expected it to be short.
This whole thing was just like a yakety sacks of rich people just messing each other. Just messing with each other. And frankly, at the end of this, Rodenstock's my hero. He looked at an entire industry that seems to be based almost entirely on how hard you can sell that something's fancy. And he said, I got these guys.
He said, hold my wine.
Yeah, he said, hold my wine. Well, I don't know what German sound like. I was going to do a French accent.
You know all of the lyrics to every Rammstein song and you don't know what German sound
like. Okay, I don't know how to make it with my own Portuguese mouth.
Okay, that's fair.
French is a little easier because it's in the same direction. So that's the story of the most fraudulent bottle of wine in history.
That is...
Forbes supposedly still owns it.
That is a beautiful story.
It's a hell of a story.
And I'm so glad you told it to me.
If you want more information, the book Billionaire's Vinegar gets so deep into this mess of a story.
That's the most concise summary title possible.
I thought you would really appreciate the title. Highly recommended reading. It's fantastic. It really gets into the nitty-gritty and the process of a lot of this if you were interested in that. It's great. I also, other sources include winespectator.com. Yes, the same website that was itself defrauded by Mr. Rodenstock. And newyorker.com, the Jefferson Bottles article, which is fantastic if you don't feel like reading the book.
Beautiful. Amazing. Incredible.
Wine is bullshit and antique wine is twice as bullshit.
If you would like to talk to us about bullshit antique wines or just want to say, hey, you can contact us directly at antiquesfreakspodcast@gmail.com, or you can hit up our Facebook page at facebook.com/antiquesfreaks. And while you're there, you can join our Facebook group, Antiques Freaks Friends, where we're going to be yelling about billionaires and wines a bunch.
Oh god, just so much.
If, like a billionaire wine collector, you would enjoy giving us some money, you can check out our Etsy shop at etsy.com/shop/antiquesfreaks, where we have a wide variety of vintage goods and t-shirts and stickers with the podcast logo on them.
If you're an enthusiast of rare wines who wants to send us enough money that we could go out and buy some ourselves, we're happy for you to prove us wrong. Just please send us the money, and we'll get right on that, I promise.
You can send that money to us through our Patreon at patreon.com/antiquesfreaks.
Where, if anyone sends us enough money for a rare wine, we'll maybe post a video of us drinking it. That won't happen.
But what if it did? And you can also join our Random Vintage Postcard of the Month Club, where we send you a random vintage postcard every month.
Woo!
Woo! Special shout out to our current patrons for all the support they've shown us for keeping our podcast solvent and paying our hosting fees and getting us ever closer to a second microphone and producing bonus episodes.
And giving us a reason to smile on the rough days.
Yeah.
It's not a joke. It really does.
And thank you for listening.
Especially you.
You specifically.
You've earned a boxed wine.
Goodbye.
Bye.